Welcome to Federalist 2.0. This is a new podcast where we explore the ways in which the Constitution, our instruction manual for how to run a government, could be improved. I'm your host, Jeff, and you can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Now, on with the show. So, welcome back, guys. I apologize for the long hiatus. It's been a weird month, as you can imagine. Following this election has been tiring, especially for people that are really plugged in, like myself and the people presumably listening to this podcast. It's been a little bit crazy. So this is going to be a bit of a different podcast. Normally, I script out everything and kind of talk through it all and make some slight deviations as I talk, but it's not off the cuff. But today I thought it'd be more appropriate to sort of pause what we've been doing and just talk about my thoughts and kind of have more of a conversational podcast today. So a little bit of a change in format before we go back into the heavy duty stuff, but wanted to kind of lay that out there. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and hopefully it works out well. Hopefully you guys like it. So let's start by talking about just the role of the executive in general. And I think it's important when we talk about the executive, and I've been talking about it a lot, but I've never really defined it. The executive is two things, and they get muddied up a lot lately. There's the executive, the person, the president, and to some degree, the vice president. And then there's the executive, the branch, everything underneath them. The role of the executive, the person, is obviously to run the branch. I think we've perhaps put too much power in the role of the person, the role of the president. We see it in debates where we see presidential candidates talk about all the time what they'll do for you. I was very surprised in 2016 to see Rand Paul not articulate his vision of limited government and libertarianism. I really expected Rand Paul to say something like, look, all these things that these people are promising are beyond what the president can promise. That's not what the president's supposed to do. If you want a president who's basically a king to give you a bunch of stuff, then vote for one of them. If you want a president who wants limited government, and wants to get government out of the way, vote for me. That's a position that I do take some issues with, but it would have been internally consistent with his brand, and it would have been a stark way to put him distinctly different from the other candidates out there that were sort of doing the standard over-promising thing. And so the executive, the person, is really supposed to, it says it in their oath of office, faithfully execute the laws. They should defend the laws. They should execute the laws. They should prioritize which laws to pursue based on the limited resources of the government. That's one thing that people sort of lose their minds over, but it was probably one of the few things that Obama did that was largely fine. In terms of the way he went about implementing DACA. Now, he tried to sort of bind future presidents, which is probably not appropriate, but it's perfectly within his right to say, look, I have limited resources. We would like to deport the illegal aliens, but we're going to prioritize different types of illegal aliens. And that's fine. That's exactly what the president should do. It's what the head of any executive agency has to do. And so that's something that we want to keep in mind as we go forward, sort of building out our new constitution, is this is what the president should do. They should not be focused on all these other things, right? It's weird to me that the White House dictates budget terms to Congress. It's weird that the White House puts out suggestions on how to fix Medicare or Social Security. These are all things that the legislature ought to put on their big boy pants and take care of themselves. I think we run some real risks, and we'll talk about those, when we implicitly imbue the presidency with so much power. Now, on the other hand, the executive, the branch, is different, right? The executive, the branch, exists to execute the laws, to run the government, to handle a lot of logistical stuff, to do all the things that the president can't do. In some sort of hypothetical world in which Superman is the president, the executive branch theoretically is not necessary. The president could do all of it, right? The president could issue Social Security checks. The president could arrest people. The president could enforce laws on parkland and federal property. You know, these are all things that, hypothetically, Superman could do, right? Unfortunately, we don't have Superman as the president. So, Congress has established an entire branch underneath him. The president's the head of that branch. But that branch exists to execute a variety of laws. We've also sort of moved the executive to having some pseudo-legislative powers. So Congress will pass a law, and then banking regulators, for example, will pass interpretations of that law as regulations. I think that's appropriate, though you get into some really dangerous territory. You want to be very careful with that, as we've talked about in the legislative section, that we want to sort of pull back on that and sort of rein that in a little bit. I think the executive branch has a number of other roles. It's probably the branch of the government that affects us the most in ways that we don't always necessarily appreciate. The FBI helps local law enforcement with forensic work. They run national parks that, all those park rangers you see, those are executive branch personnel. They issue Social Security and Medicare checks. These are ways in which they touch our lives more meaningfully than probably any other branch of the federal government. But the Constitution is weirdly quiet on the executive branch itself. It focuses kind of on the presidency and the vice presidency, but not really spending a lot of time talking about the executive branch per se as an entity, which is why we get into some concepts like the unitary executive that we're going to talk about here in a second. But I think fleshing out what we expect from the branch and drawing a line between the person, the executive, the person, and the executive, the branch, is important. I think we've seen that line blurred increasingly over the last few years, really the last couple decades. And I think it's not quite at a danger point, but it's certainly getting very close to it, where we need to take a step back and ask ourselves some hard questions. When we set up the federal government, we set up the Constitution, we had very real concerns about the consolidated power that a king would have. There was even discussions originally about making George Washington king. That was a very real idea that was floated out there, that he would have been King George the First of America. It was quickly scuppered, thank goodness, and through George Washington's maybe most singular act of dedication, he set the precedent that lasted for over 150 years of only having two terms as presidency. And that was something that I think was a incredible act of sacrifice and self-control. I think that should be applauded and isn't always recognized quite enough, and isn't recognized for the extraordinary step that it was. He realized the danger of consolidation of power. He recognized the near reverence that many in America held him in. And he wanted to take a step back and say, this isn't good. It isn't healthy. And it's not the precedent I want to set. And we have elections, and we set this process up to have elections, and by golly, we should have real elections. And if that means me stepping back so that we can have those, then so be it. And I think that danger of consolidated power is something that we're getting into the danger zone on. And so I think we've turned to the presidency for too much. We have imbued a lot of power in the executive branch and the presidency specifically. I think moving that power from the legislature to the executive branch isn't necessarily a problem. But when we then move it up and consolidate it into an individual, that's where you get into real issues. So I think, and like I said, we're going to talk a little bit about the unitary executive, but I think the unitary executive is a nice idea if the executive branch is very weak. If the executive branch is very strong, then you can't do that. It becomes very unhealthy, very dangerous, and leaves you vulnerable to one bad egg. And I think we're seeing that right now. And we've seen that over the last 4 years. Regardless of how you feel about Trump, I think it's fair to say that the power that Trump has exercised, if a president that was not, if a president was took that power, it was a president that you disagreed with their policies on. So if you're a Democrat, if it's Trump, you feel this way obviously right now, but even if you're a Republican, if it had been Obama doing many of the things and exercising some of the power that that Trump has shown in terms of pardoning people that are integral to investigations of him and firing people and moving to be able to fire more people in a way that I think if it had been Obama or Hillary or somebody else, I think many Republicans would be very, very uncomfortable with at the least and probably up in arms with the most. I think we've seen a demonstration of the kind of consolidation of power in a single person that's not healthy. And you know, we can argue about whether or not Trump has exercised that power unhealthily, but I think we would all agree that if we had 4 years of Trump and 4 years of Hillary doing similar exercises of power, we'd all have 4 years to point to in sort of terror and fear. And so I think we've hit that point of consolidation of power that we need to sort of step back and say, what do we really want the president himself to be able to do? How much of the executive needs to be imbued in that single person? I know that was kind of muddied, and maybe I didn't articulate that well, but hopefully everybody sort of follows and sort of generally agrees with that point. So let's talk a little bit about the unitary executive, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation that gets thrown around about it. There's this sort of scary idea of it that gets promoted in certain circles. And honestly, I think the people that are afraid of it don't understand it enough to know why they should be afraid of it. And so they're almost not afraid enough. They're sort of pointing at the wrong things. So I think let's sort of spell it out. But the legal theory goes that because the Constitution is largely silent on the executive branch itself as an apparatus and really just establishes the executive the person, that all power within the executive branch flows up to and from the president, and that the president can do literally anything within the executive branch that he wants. Not literally anything, period, but the idea would be that the only restraints on the presidency would be impeachment and election. And He is solely in charge of interpreting the laws. He is solely in charge of executing those laws, and everybody else reports up to him. And so the president could theoretically change regulations just by executive order. He could get rid of regulations. He could add new ones that were within the law, right? He doesn't get to interpret a regulation that says that bank interest rates can't be over 18%. He can't interpret that to say that the federal government should stop carbon dioxide from being emitted into the atmosphere. That would be challenged in court. And I think even the staunchest unitary executive proponent would say, well, yeah, that would lose, right? But he does get to define, if it's left up to the definitions of the law, he gets to define what a deposit rate is, right? He gets to define how that interest rate is calculated, right? So if the Congress passes a law that says deposit rates can't go above 18%, then he can say whether that 18% is calculated simple interest or compound interest, for example. He can determine what is a deposit, within the ordinary understanding of the word, right? So the unitary executive allows the president to do everything. And so you saw, this was the argument when the Flynn investigation was happening, and Comey was being sort of told to back off of Flynn, and there was a lot of hand-wringing about that. And people in the unitary executive would suggest, proponents of that theory would suggest that the president is fully within his rights to tell the FBI to not investigate anybody. Theoretically, the president could, let's just give a hypothetical. A dead body is found in the White House. The president could order the FBI, who would normally investigate that, to not investigate that crime or to not investigate certain suspects in that crime. That would be an extraordinary action. That would be an extraordinary action that, I'd like to think would lead to an impeachment. But proponents of the unitary executive idea would suggest that he's within his constitutional power to make that order to the FBI. So the unitary executive really funnels a lot of power into a single person. And that's the thing to actually be worried about, is that it continues to funnel power even beyond the sort of implicit power we've given the president. It explicitly makes the president the be-all end-all of executive action. And I think that's the reason why it's just not, it's not a good idea. It's not something that is workable for a larger government. In a world in which we have a very, very small federal government, we could talk about whether or not that's a good idea, and maybe it probably is. But in a world in which we've got an executive government that's got to govern 50 states, several territories, the world's biggest military, and 330 million some odd people, I think it's infusing way too much power in a single person. So right now I'm recording this on Friday the 6th. The election looks like it's likely to go for Biden. At this point in the recording, Georgia's flipped to be in favor of Biden. Pennsylvania is expected to be blue once this last little batch of votes is counted. In fact, it may have already turned blue. Arizona doesn't look like it'll change either. So it looks like it's going to be probably 306 electoral votes for Biden. I have a lot of mixed emotions, and we'll get to who I voted for and why here in a second, because I think it's important for you guys to understand where I'm coming from politically. We won't spend a lot of time talking about current politics in this podcast, but right now we're voting on the next executive of the United States, and we're about to talk about the executive branch. And frankly, I think it's important to know. You know, I think what the president has done in the last couple of days has been not as bad as I feared it would be, but certainly not in keeping with what I think an appropriate way to approach an election is. And I think that's played out here pretty demonstrably. He made an early claim on Wednesday that, you know, they were claiming Pennsylvania. They're trying to stop the counts. You know, he's pushing for stopping the counts in Pennsylvania, but continuing the counts in Arizona. So he wants to keep the count going in places he's losing and stop the count in places he's winning. And these are, you know, I think relevant to us in this discussion. These are counts of ballots that have come in before election day. So there's not a lot of argument for not counting them, other than because he really strongly encouraged his people to vote on election day and poo-pooed mail-in ballots. The ballots had this sort of blue-red shift between election day ballots and mail-in ballots. So, you know, look, it was some real kind of lunacy going on here, and unhealthy behavior. But it does look like we're going to end up getting a Biden-Harris presidency, and that looks like where we're likely going to land. I realized in talking to my daughter about this and my nephew, who I've spent a lot of time talking to, I don't think I ever spelled out why, at a high level, I think a representative democracy makes sense. I consider myself a very plugged in person. I pay attention to a lot of stuff. I read Supreme Court opinions. I follow laws that are getting passed. I actually read the laws sometimes when time permits. But there's the key, when time permits, right? I have a full-time job. I don't have the luxury of making myself as informed as I can and should be if I were going to actually vote on these laws. And so we vote in people that are going to represent us, right? We vote in congressmen for the House. We vote in senators in the Senate. Theoretically, in our new constitution, we would also vote in parliamentarians. We vote in a president. These are all people that represent us in different ways. And we vote them in because we don't have the time to fully engage and learn about the issues to make something like a direct democracy work. And so we have this representative democracy. And because of that's the way I think about it, my first filter on who I vote for is never on ideology. Okay? I don't want somebody, honestly, who only agrees with me on every single issue. That sounds weird to say, and I think, you know, hypothetically, I would like that person. But agreeing with me on every single issue as a knee-jerk reaction means that you won't know when to compromise or bend on what you believe or change your opinion. And there's a danger there. So my first test, the first gate you have to pass to get my vote is you have to be, you know, some flavor of good person. That's a really tenuous thing. We can never really know. I think a lot of politicians are bad people and are good at hiding it. But you know, there's a very low sort of Mendoza level bar for that for me. Beyond that, though, they also have to show me that they're intelligent and intellectually curious about things. Having an idiot who doesn't want to learn about things in an elected office is dangerous, honestly. They're not going to they're not going to make good decisions about a lot of issues, and they're definitely not going to make good decisions when confronted with novel issues. I think this pandemic has proven that when confronted with a novel issue of what to do with a highly contagious airborne disease, more deadly than the flu, but not smallpox deadly, our federal government sort of paralyzed because the person at the top that we had elected was not the kind of person who was willing to learn about the issues and make an intelligent decision. And then you couple that with, he was also not somebody who was comfortable letting others underneath him make decisions. He wanted to be the one making the decision. He wanted to be sort of the face of this, that decision-making process. And I think that's how we got where we got, you know, we didn't make good decisions. We've made weird lockdown decisions that were sort of one size fits all. We've made insane decisions about not testing and not ramping up testing. We've done many, many, many things wrong because we elected a president who doesn't learn things and doesn't know how to filter out and listen to the right people. And I think in a representative democracy, before you vote on ideology, you've got to make sure that the person that you're voting for is intelligent and intellectually curious. And probably it's good to also have some level of humility, some ability to sort of check your ego at the door and listen to other people. Listen to, you know, admit that there are people that know more about something than you do. They don't have to be a super genius. I'm not somebody who says that the only person in elected office should be very, 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 very smart people. But they ought to be, look, I think it's probably fair to say they ought to be above average intelligence. And I think that's an important prerequisite for running a very complicated government and a very complicated world. So I think it's pretty obvious, based on what I've already said, that I did not vote for Trump. I voted for Biden. I was happy to vote for Biden. I think Biden passes my test more than Trump does by a wide margin, as I've laid out. And we don't have to get to the ideology part, where I don't agree with Biden's ideology on a lot of things. But I was happy to vote for him because I think he generally is a good person. He passes that bar that I've set. I think he's intelligent. He's not brilliant by any stretch of the imagination. He's, you know, an average to above average intelligence. I think he's intellectually curious, and I think he's got some humility and listens to people. And so is he going to make the best decision all the time? No. Is he going to make decisions I agree with for the next 4 years? Probably not. But when confronted with novel issues and crises, is he going to make the decision that he thinks is best for the country? I think definitely. And I don't think you can necessarily say that about Trump. I think Trump has shown that he'll make the best decision for himself. But I haven't seen a lot of evidence to suggest that Trump will make the best decision for the country. I don't see a lot of sacrifice from him on things. Maybe that's uncharitable. That's just what I've seen. For a barometer here, my adult life president votes have been, before I was an adult, I would have voted for Perot. I did not. In 92, I was not old enough. But I really liked Perot. The Stockdale debate, I still remember being catastrophically bad. For those of you too young to have seen that, go on YouTube and look for the Admiral Stockdale vice presidential debate and prepare to feel your skin crawl, because it's very, very, very cringeworthy. It was pretty painful. And I think a lot of people believe but for that debate, Perot would have taken enough electoral votes to prevent Clinton and Bush from getting 270. Would have voted for Perot in 92, would not have voted for Perot in 96 because he went a little bit cuckoo in 96. So I didn't vote in 96. And then I voted in every election since then. I voted for Gore in 2000. I voted for Bush in 2004. I voted for McCain in 2008, which I think 2008 was the one presidential election I can remember where I was pretty happy to vote for either of them. I think McCain or Obama, both of those were good, intellectually curious people looking to do the right thing. And were trying to be public servants. And I was happy to vote for either one of them. I wish I could have voted for both. I voted for Obama in 2012. I voted for Hillary very begrudgingly in 2016. I was very much in the camp of, is this seriously the best we can get from both parties? I did not like either of them. I felt like the downside risk for Trump was more than the downside risk for Hillary. I was willing to put somebody in office who was a bit of an egomaniac, I think a little bit, crooked is the wrong word, compromised perhaps morally, selfish, self-centered morally, in much the same way that Trump was. But with Hillary, I felt like it was kind of the devil I knew. And whereas I thought the upside risk was not very good for Hillary, I thought I'd get 4 years of being kind of low grade, not happy. I thought the downside risk was much, much less than Trump. And I really believe that in this, if we had this pandemic under a Hillary Clinton administration, I think we'd handle things a lot better, much better. And then I voted for Biden the other day, and I'm happier to vote for Biden, certainly, than I was for Hillary. I did not enjoy voting for Hillary one bit. But I think Biden's going to be a good president, you know, in a lot of ways. I look forward to not waking up every morning and checking the news cycle for what crazy thing the president said. I think he'll probably just be a caretaker, and we'll get a real runoff in, we'll get a real run of new people in 2024. Maybe that's Harris Pence. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's Harris and Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley or Ben Sasse or Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz. I mean, there's a bunch of senators sort of chomping at the bit. There'll probably be some governors that come to the fore in the meantime. And Harris, I don't think, is going to go like completely uncontested either. So I think 2024 is going to be a lot like 2016 in terms of a lot of chaos and a lot of questions about who the actual eventual nominees are going to be. I hope that doesn't lead for the opportunity for another demagogue on either side to show up. I think there's a possibility when you have very fractured fields to get very, the optimum strategy for a candidate when you've got 20 some odd candidates is to say crazy stuff, get your name out there and lock in your 15 or 20% loyal supporters, right? You can get whatever Looney Tunes you want to support you, but in a field of 20, if you're at 20%, you're in the lead. And those big fields can really lead to some weird polarizing fringe candidates. And I think that's a very real risk that we're going to have to confront in 2024. And I think it's going to come from both sides. And I think we need to be on guard for that and prepped for that. So anyway, that's where I'm coming from. Feel free to yell at me. Feel free to compliment me. But I think I've laid out my rationale pretty well there. So sorry for this longer than normal, probably a little bit rambling and you know, if I'm being honest, I guess a little self-centered because I focused on my opinions a lot. Sorry for that change of pace in the episode. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Hopefully you got to know where I'm coming from a little bit better. You know, we'll get back into it on a regular schedule starting next week. I've got the script about halfway written, but I really did have to kind of throw out a lot of my script from before and reassess a lot of how I was thinking about the executive just in general. in preparation for this. So we'll talk more about the executive next week and the vision that I have for that branch of the government. But until then, stay safe. Hopefully this election has, calmed down by the time you read this, and cooler heads are prevailing, and we're not having crazy riots in the street or anything. I know these are stressful times for everybody on both sides. My heart goes out to everybody, but I think at this point I'm cautiously optimistic we're going to get through all this. The union will survive, and I think we'll come out stronger and hopefully address some of the, I think people will be receptive and open to the ideas of fixing some of the failings in the Constitution that have allowed us to get to the point we're at. Anyway, look forward to talking to you next time. That's it for today. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Federalist 2.0. My name is Jeff. You can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Please remember to like and subscribe. Apparently, giving 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really helps, so if you're using that service, please do that. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.